Thank you very much, Luca, for the kind invitation to give this talk. And it's a pleasure to be here. And this is a talk I will try to keep very simple because I don't want to go into very much detail on holography, for instance. I want to focus actually on geometric aspects of surfaces and definition that may be useful in the context of holography, but not only limited to that. So I will make a very quick and very broad introduction about the surfaces, codimension two functionals, and I will try to relate this with the concept of renormalized volume, which typically appears in the context of black hole thermodynamics in the bulk. And I will comment on standard techniques in order to render the volume renormalized in asymptotically less gravity. So I will talk about the codimension two functionals, including the area, and how to renormalize the notion of area when the surface is in contact with the conformal boundary. And I will show a very simple example. This is the four-dimensional example in the bulk, where everything can be done, not everything, but to a certain extent, the notion of renormalized area can be reproduced from the addition of a topological term in the bulk. And generalizations of the notion of the renormalized area, it will involve additional contributions that I will try to motivate, and I will manage to reproduce finally everything as coming from conformal gravity also in the bulk. I will try to justify the fact that this embedding of Einstein gravity in conformal gravity in a constructive way. So this is just for the advertising. I'm trying to make contact with the notion of energy functionals that appears in different, completely different contexts in biological systems. I also like to show this picture because I'm obsessed by soap bubbles. But also notions of energy in two dimensions as coming from what is called Willmore energy that have become relevant also in the context of holographic entanglement entropy in recent time, because you are able to prove certain bounds for the holographic entanglement entropy based on this notion. In a context that had nothing to do with gravity at all, the Willmore energy is defined for a surface like the square of what is called mean curvature, that is actually expressed into the extrinsic curvature of the surface. In a two-dimensional surface, there is a single normal, so there is a single extrinsic curvature that you may define. But I won't be limited to that interest, but I will also try to make connection with the notion of holographic entanglement entropy as prescribed, as it appears in the original prescription by Ryu and Takayanagi in 2006. These are surfaces which are attached, I anchor to the conformal boundary of asymptotically ADS spacetime. So in the picture there, you are omitting the time direction. So this is just the spatial picture of this realization of a holographic prescription for entanglement entropy from the CFT, for the CFT living at the conformal boundary. This was also realized later by Leukowitz and Maldacena in 2013 in the form of a cosmic brain that is also attached to the conformal boundary. Because I have been long enough in the community to to remember that in the 90s, actually, there was a similar, that what Maldacena actually did, it was a sort of generalization of the notion of that was originally developed in the context of black hole entropy. Black hole entropy is actually the conjugate variable to the conical deficit that you can construct when you study the Euclidean version of a black hole. This was developed almost simultaneously by Solodugin and these three guys are more famous for the three-dimensional black hole. But this is also an interesting paper where, in the context of black hole thermodynamics, they see the black hole entropy as the conjugate variable to the conical deficit. So if you take a gravitational action with a conical deficit that is in the RT plane, in the Euclidean version, you can take the limit of the certain limit in the conical deficit and derivatives coming from the evaluation of the Euclidean action in manifolds that contain a conical deficit. So this is a sort of old story. So what about, part of the title of the talk is renormalized volume. I will motivate renormalized volume by a very simple example at the verge of triviality, which is the following thing. Whenever you are interested to compute black hole thermodynamics, you consider the Euclidean version of Einstein gravity, this time with negative cosmological constant. So if you use the equation of motion, you take the trace of the equation of motion, you prove that the Euclidean action, the value of the Euclidean action, is nothing but the volume integrated between the horizon and radial infinity. So that's the reason why the notion of volume in asymptotic LDS spacetime is divergent. It contains a very big divergent term like this. It's very much interesting because actually, if you don't consider the addition of any boundary term, like Gibbons Hawking term, to set a well-defined variational problem, you don't get the Hamiltonian mass, you get a fraction of the Hamiltonian mass. This is important because this is connected to a very long-standing problem of definition of energy in general relativity, what is called the Comar superpotential, Comar mass, or whatever. We have this problem of a sort of anomalous factors. And so you reproduce the black hole thermodynamics as coming from the horizon, and there is a divergent term as you approach the boundary. So very simple computation. And how to address this problem? This is not the only way, but is the way it typically appears in the context of holography. In asymptotic LDS gravity, there is this prescription that is the fact that on top of the standard Gibbons-Hawking term, you consider the addition of local counter terms. And it was done around 99 in early years of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And it's essentially, it relies on the fact that you're solving the asymptotic form of the metric from a certain data into the conformal boundary into the bulk, sort of radial evolution of the system. And you need, because of the Gibbons-Hawking term, you added because of getting rid of variations of the extrinsic curvature, of the normal derivative of the metric, you have to consider only intrinsic counterterms which do not spoil the Dirichlet problem for the metric at the boundary. So, of course, this is sort of, it's a very systematic procedure. It doesn't mean that it's not complicated. And you need certain number of counterterms as you go up in the dimension. For instance, you only need a counterterm that is essentially the volume of the boundary in three dimensions, because not even in three dimensions the action is renormalized. Let's say for the VTZ black hole in three dimensions, the action is also divergent if you add only the Gibbons Hawking term. So you need counterterms. For instance, you need two counterterms in four dimensions. This is a power counting argument in the radial coordinates. And the expression is, in principle, you can solve it up to certain numbers of the derivatives. This is a derivative expansion.
Sorry, just a better understanding. Can you clarify, would you want to renormalize it? I mean, I was thinking that if you're looking, because you mentioned at some point Hamiltonians, Comer, and things like this, if you want to, for instance, renormalize, well, let's say you're computing Brownian charges, then you have this divergence, but there's no such freedom, such huge ambiguity. You just put the embedding of kappa in flat Minkowski space, and that's enough. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why are you just not doing that here? What are
this is asymptotically ADS. Is there a difference?
Why don't you just put K of ADS, and that's it? It doesn't work.
You mean background subtraction?
Right.
No, it's always an alternative. But for instance, you miss some information like Weyl anomaly, because if you implement background subtraction procedures, you won't be able to compute, for instance, information, holographic information like anomalies.
I see. So if you were just interested in, let's say, Hamiltonian, it might be enough. But you're still interested in other calculations.
This is the typical example. And also, let me give you yet another example. That is, I mean, then you make the difference between background subtraction and background independent procedures. The typical example that I always give regarding this issue is gravitational instantons. Gravitational instantons are such configurations which are asymptotically ADS that it's not easy to find a proper background, proper background to refer to. So, for instance, because they locally asymptotes to the global ADS, pure ADS, but they have defects. So it's not you don't reach by tuning the parameters, you don't necessarily go to global ADS, yeah, like Schwarzschild ADS. So I'm focusing, true, I'm focusing on background independent procedures. So let's consider what is the effect of the presence of these defects I was referring in the case of computations of holographic entanglement entropy. The cosmic brain in the case, it can be, if you look from far away, it can be seen as a conical defect. So you can study always the problem of what is the evaluation of gravitational actions in manifolds with a conical defect. And this has been studied for long, at least in the simplest case, linear in the curvature, and also quadratic terms in the curvature. And what you induce in the case of Einstein gravity is nothing but the area. So essentially, if you evaluate the Einstein-Hilbert action in a manifold that contains a conical defect, you can split the contributions in a regular part. That means eliminating the conical defect. So this is the regular part of the action, and a singular part. And the singular part is nothing, in the Einstein case, is nothing but the area. It's the area functional defined in codimension 2, with a contribution that is of the type of the conical defect. It's linear in the conical defect. So at the end of the day, in the holographic prescription for entanglement entropy, they were claiming that the holographic entanglement entropy is dual to Einstein gravity for a minimal surface. And the minimality is defined in codimension 2. There are two normals, so you can define extrinsic curvatures along two different normal vectors, and the condition of minimality is the trace of the extrinsic curvature is equal to zero. This is the minimization of the area functional. So, but the area functional, because the surfaces you are interested in, they are anchored to the conformal boundary, this notion of area is of course divergent as well as the volume, as I show you, the volume of the space-time. So there is a prescription. There were several authors, in particular Taylor and Woodhead, who were considering the application of standard holographic renormalization procedure and the further projection to codimension 2 in order to render this area functional finite, essentially, and to be able to extract holographic information out of this quantity. So they essentially apply a standard holographic renormalization procedure, and then they construct counterterms and they essentially project in codimension 2. Counterterms is something living in codimension 1, and you need to project yet another term to codimension 2. That is sort of painful, even in the simplest case. So this is part of my motivation, because I would like to try to find a procedure that is maybe it gives you a more geometric approach to this problem in particular.
Sorry, is that the replica trick?
Yeah. First, the conical defect is induced by the replica trick, but in principle, you have the area as a codimension 2 functional, and this is not free from the divergences which are coming from the conformal boundaries. So you need to do some renormalization procedure in a way in codimension 2. So let's go back to the problem of renormalization in the volume, in the bulk, for a while, to try to get some idea where this new proposal could come from. And I will also make this comment that a posteriori is almost trivial, but in a certain moment it was very puzzling, for at least for me, for a while. That is the following thing. Let's consider the addition to the gravitational action, a standard Einstein-Hilbert with negative cosmological constant, of the following object. It looks strange at first glance, but it had a topological origin. This boundary term I call second Chern form is actually the Chern-Simons form associated to the Lorentz group, because it's associated to a topological term, which is the Gauss-Bonnet, that is a topological term for the Lorentz group as well. So this boundary term written in a particular coordinate system, typically Gauss normal coordinates, is a polynomial in both extrinsic and intrinsic curvatures. And this is nothing new. It comes from the Euler theorem. And the Euler theorem essentially says that in a manifold without a boundary, if you integrate a topological term, it gives you a topological number. But if you introduce a boundary, you have to introduce also a boundary correction to the Euler characteristic. And the boundary correction is nothing but this second Chern form. It's a polynomial, once again, the extrinsic and intrinsic curvature. It looks sort of complicated, but it existed in the literature. So it's connected to this Gauss-Bonnet term, which is a precise combination of quadratic terms in the curvature, and it doesn't contribute to the equation of motion. So that's the reason why it's locally a boundary term. And from the dynamic point of view, these two things are equivalent, because this is just a topological number whose variation is zero. So when you do black hole thermodynamics with this proposal, it corrects the problem that you have It corrects two problems, actually. It corrects the missing factor of the mass, and it cancels the divergence in the volume. So you are doing two things at the same time. It's interesting, and you could extend this concept. You can always add a topological term in every even dimension. There is the Euler term that you can add. It always acts in this way. Not only for Schwarzschild black holes, for Kerr black holes, for other topologies, it's pretty much interesting, but it's sort of, at the same time, it's very intriguing, because I was puzzled by these results at first, because we couldn't understand the connection with the standard procedure, with the standard asymptotic resolution of the metric in a certain coordinate frame. So here, I'm reproducing black hole thermodynamics from the addition of a topological term in four dimensions.
Sorry, what is C3 again?
C3 is I didn't want to write the coupling in front of B3. I didn't want this precise coupling.
But it's a free parameter?
No.
So what fixes it?
Is
that number there?
Yes, the regularity of the Euclidean action.
But would I be fair if I said that you can start with a free parameter and it turns out that actually
yes.
You can fix
this is connected
by
this is
one free parameter.
This is connected to the fact that you had a freedom in the Gauss-Bonnet.
What is non-trivial is the fact that by fixing one parameter you were able to solve two problems.
Yes. Okay. This is what the addition of Gauss-Bonnet with a fixed coupling does. It solves these two problems. So then, in order to compare with the standard holographic techniques, you have to understand what you are doing, because it's very, very unusual. Of course, some people wanted to hang me in a Pavlov square because of this sort of addition of extrinsic terms, because in principle, you may say that the variational problem is ill-defined. Because the variational problems is typically based on Dirichlet boundary conditions for the metric, but this is had to be something else, or you have to understand what exactly you are doing.
So why is that? I mean, you can have variational problem with any boundary condition.
Yeah. But in the way you were mentioning, Brown-York is done with Dirichlet boundary conditions.
Yeah, you can change that.
No. Now I understand that. I mean, this was many years ago, almost 20 years back. I mean, people had a different way of thinking.
Thank you.
So actually what saves you is exactly what you're saying. You have to take different boundary conditions. And this is based on the following observation that in a particular coordinate frame, which is suitable to account for the properties of the conformal boundary, because at the boundary of ADS, everything is divergent. So there is a divergence of order 2 in the set coordinate, in the holographic coordinate. So at the end of the day, what you're doing is the fact that there were several people pointing out the fact that a Dirichlet problem does not really make sense in asymptotic ADS because it's actually the boundary metric is divergent. You have a divergence of order 2. And so in principle, they were claiming that the renormalization is ultimately related to the variational problem in terms of the holographic data, not the full boundary metric. This is compatible with holography in particular, so they were able to take the variation of the full action and express it in terms of the holographic stress tensor instead. So let's have a look on what happened at the level of the extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature actually had the same behavior. They had this divergence of order 2 at the leading order. What happens is everything mixed up, the intrinsic contributions mix up with the extrinsic contributions. So at the end of the day, you learn that if you add these counter terms that depends on the extrinsic curvature, you may end up anyway with something that is finite and is expressible in terms of the sources at the boundary. So that anyway, you have the chance, even though you are adding extrinsic contributions at the boundary, this still can have a holographic interpretation of the theory, because at the end of the day, your renormalized action is finite and is expressible in terms of the holographic sources. And in order to perform the computation, I mean, in order for people to match both prescription, it was necessary to play the game of expansions of the metric. I mean, if you see the expression of these boundary terms I was using, there is no such a term as Gibbons Hawking term. There is nothing linear in the extrinsic curvature. So you force the system to behave like that. You add and subtract the Gibbons Hawking term and expand. And to make the long story short, at the end of the day, when you expand this second chain form, you manage to reproduce the Gibbons Hawking term plus standard counter terms, which are intrinsic. Because, I mean, the series is infinite, but because of a power counting argument in four dimensions, only the first two counter terms matter. So at the end of the day, the prescription in the context of ADS-CFT is nothing but the addition of a topological term. It's a nice observation. Because of the following thing. When you fix the coupling of the Gauss-Bonnet, the action, I mean, you trade off the second fundamental, the second term form by the topological terms, you pick up an additional Euler characteristic there, which will become relevant for some discussion. And it's also interesting to note the fact that this coupling, this precise coupling, have been found also in the supersymmetric context. If you perform supersymmetric transformation and keep track of all the contributions which appear also at the boundary, you will end up fixing the coupling in the same way. So what is this comparison between topological terms as standard holographic techniques? The addition of a topological term in four dimensions is the same as holographic techniques. In higher dimension, the addition of topological term, there is a mismatch with the holographic renormalization. But for instance, if your space-time is asymptotically conformally flat, I mean, if you leave aside gravitational instantons, you will produce the same results as holographic renormalization. So in higher dimensions, holographic renormalization is almost the same as holographic techniques. I mean, and the mismatch, now we understand, for instance, in the six-dimensional case, how to patch up this mismatch with the holographic renormalization. But I will focus in just in four dimensions this talk. Tell me.
So odd D in the bulk?
Odd D in the bulk, what you learn is that you can always add a polynomial of the extrinsic curvature. This is a very long story to tell, and I have never been able to relate to any existing object in the mathematical literature, but there is a prescription. And it reproduces the same results as black hole thermodynamics and vacuum energy and these sort of things.
Aren't those terms that you're mentioning for odd in the bulk related to the abstraction tensor?
No. This is related. I mean, when you consider odd dimensional asymptotically ADS gravity in the bulk, you have to consider a boundary term which is an even form. An even form can appear sort of corner contributions in Chern-Simons formulations. In Chern-Simons formulation, when you have this trick of sort of gauge invariant extension of Chern-Simons forms, I know them like transgression forms, depends on two connections, and they touch each other at a boundary. And what you produce at the boundary is an even form from the point of view of differential forms. And it's sort of related to this sort of this construction. But it's not, and there is a prescription we gave long time ago, but it's not a mathematical object that is, appears in the textbooks. No, the, I mean, this is the term form, very standard. But the other is more intricated, I would say.
So just for curiosity, and on this, the anti-de Sitter solution, the renormalized action is zero, or you get something?
Yes.
Is it just for curiosity? Okay.
Yes, exactly. Because actually, this is another way of fixing the coupling of the topological term. Because in order to match black hole thermodynamics,
that's very
global ADS have to be zero. Right. The charges are also proportional to the Weyl tensor. I will explain this. So everything is compatible with black hole thermodynamics. A minimal requirement that you have to ask.
Sorry, do you know if this action is related to the McDowell-Mansoury action?
Yeah, this I wanted to comment later. This is McDowell-Mansoury action, yes. It's, McDowell-Mansoury action is self-renormalized. It's built-in renormalized. It's an interesting fact. Let me go in that direction because I want to make connection at the end with conformal gravity. And this is one of the key ingredients of the constructions. So let's study codimension two functionals for quadratic terms in the curvature. So this is a systematic procedure that was elaborated by these three guys, Fursayev, Patrushev, Soloduhin, 2013. They decompose the contributions, conical contributions, in quadratic terms in the curvature. This is interesting because, in principle, this is an expansion in powers of the conical defect. And so you have the regular part, you have here the regular part, and you have the singular part. And just to fix the notation, A and B, capital A and B, they are normal directions, I, J, they are codimension two indices. So these are contributions of the type of the extrinsic curvature in codimension two in, on the surface. And then you have Ricci of the bulk with certain components and so on. And the interesting thing that if you combine these three things in the Gauss-Bonnet combination, in principle, these are there are higher order contributions, but just for the Gauss-Bonnet combination, is finite. It is cut at linear order in the conical defect. Also, you can decompose the Euler characteristic for in a of the manifold in the regular and the singular part. And the singular part will enter with the conical defect linearly in the conical defect. And at the end of the day, what you get is this formula, that the singular part is nothing but sort of contribution on top of the area which cancel the divergences coming from the conformal boundary. Let me write it in a different way. So holographic entanglement entropy, we managed to renormalize the area of the surface in this expression that is not ours. We make contact with some mathematicians that wrote down this expression for minimal surfaces. Minimal surfaces, the renormalized area for minimal surfaces is sort of this contribution. This is a sort of something that measures deviation respect to the constant curvature condition. It would be like the equivalent of the Weyl tensor in higher dimensions, but you are just in two dimensions, so you cannot define. So this measures contributions with respect to this condition, and you have a purely topological contribution, which is also interesting. People had computed before, but they had not realized that they could isolate the contributions essentially in a local term and in a topological term. So this removes divergences coming from the anchoring points to the conformal boundary, and they have to be minimal surfaces because the minimal surfaces touch the conformal boundary at orthogonally. So this is nice. It's already a nice result. But so the interesting features of this procedure is the fact that somehow, and I like to say in this way, the renormalization of the volume induces the renormalization of the area in this case. So if you add a topological term, you also add a topological term in codimension 2, and you get a renormalized area. Also, this quantity I was referring measures the deviation respect to a constant curvature surface. And for a constant curvature surface, the renormalized area is purely topological. And this is, we match the standard results, but the approach was completely different. And I think I'm at the part where I have to motivate what follows. This is nice, but it doesn't remove the divergences coming from anchoring points when the surface is not minimal, when it doesn't touch orthogonally the surface. Also, because of different reasons, it has been justified in the literature, people are looking for codimension 2 functionals which are conformal invariant, and this is not conformal invariant. And actually, as a way, what I will present is a way of trying to link these two notions of renormalization and conformal invariance in codimension 2 as coming from the renormalization of the action also with a conformal invariant. And this I call it conformal renormalization. I will explain. So what I have in mind, what is conformal renormalization? Is actually embedding Einstein gravity in conformal gravity. And because what the picture I had in mind is this, that in four dimensions, any Einstein space is a solution of conformal gravity. Why I had in mind this? Because it has been proven in the relatively recent literature that conformal gravity is actually finite for asymptotically, even relaxed asymptotically DS boundary conditions by Grumiller and collaborators. And why I'm interested in this? Because if, with the hope that the renormalization of the full theory of conformal gravity will be inherited by the Einstein sector of the theory, if I define properly Einstein as a sector of conformal gravity, and conformal gravity is renormalized, also should be the case of the Einstein sector. And how we should do this? And then I need some recent results in order to go between, switch off certain modes and go between conformal gravity and Einstein gravity in a very precise way. And how I do this? This is the observation also that you made. This is another piece of evidence that is actually, this is McDowell-Mansouri action that appears in many years ago as a symmetry breaking mechanism. But what you have to notice is the following thing. If you have the general form of the Weyl tensor, you have the Riemann tensor and the skew symmetric product between the Schouten tensor and the metric, essentially. And for an Einstein space, the Schouten tensor, because it's proportional to the Ricci and the Ricci scalar, is proportional to the metric. And it picks up this contribution at the level of the Weyl tensor. And this is something I always emphasize. I don't have from the group theoretical point of view. What is the connection of the ADS group? Is the spin connection along rotation generators? And the field vine along translations. And the algebra is J with J, it's like Lorentz, J with P is P, but P with P is once again J. So when you construct the field strength and you take the commutators, this is the Lorentz curvature plus an additional thing. And the torsion. Forget about torsion in a Riemannian geometry. But this object is actually that object that appears here. It's essentially the non-vanishing part of the curvature associated to the ADS group. So these two notions of curvature in Einstein gravity coincide.
I have two questions reviewing the slides before. What did you mean when you say conformal gravity is finite?
They check it out at the level of the action. What they took, they expanded the metric and they compute, and it doesn't contain divergent terms. You don't need extra counter terms.
Extra with respect to the Einstein counter terms, or extra?
No. Extra like boundary counter terms. This Weyl square is finite.
But you mean just classically evaluated?
Classically. I'm not.
But it's surprising, right? It's surprising.
Yes.
You have Weyl squared, so in black hole solutions, or I don't know, in which you will have singularities, and so it's quite surprising that it's still. Were they making some topological assumption or removing singularities?
Maybe they were dealing only with the asymptotic behavior. I'm not so sure whether they were.
It's a global statement because it's the on shell action.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So it depends on the metric everywhere.
No, but I think what they meant is that the power to which you approach the boundary is finite. You don't have.
Not the interior. Yes, you're right.
Not finite.
It's the asymptotic behavior. It's the asymptotic behavior.
Finite. And without any counter term.
Yes.
Okay, and I have another question. So here you are, so the McDowell-Mansouri you're talking about is without that angle, right? So you're not talking about contracting for them?
Not yet. No, I'm not going to talk about it.
Okay, thanks.
But there is a similar argument also for contracting. So, okay, so written in this way, for an Einstein space, the renormalized action is Weyl square. It's a trick of the light, because you would say this had nothing to do with conformal gravity yet, because it's still a second derivative gravity theory. So you start to think that it's actually renormalized action written in this way. It's a sector of conformal gravity. And then you go and find this argument of Maldacena in 2011. And he was claiming, let me give some features of conformal gravity first. If you take the variation of the action respect to the metric, you produce something called the Bach tensor. It's a fourth derivative object. There are covariant derivatives of the Cotton tensor, and the Cotton tensor is defined in terms of the Schouten tensor. The Schouten tensor is proportional to the Ricci and the Ricci scalar. So this is a fourth derivative object, and it had to contain, from the holographic point of view, it had to contain new sources, a new stress tensor as well. And notice that in the Einstein branch of the theory, the metric is expanded in even powers of the holographic coordinate. In this case, in order to accommodate new sources, you have to think of a linear term in a new holographic source. And then Maldacena was saying, if you take Neumann boundary conditions, you take the derivative and switch off, this term, you go back essentially to the Einstein branch of the theory. And this can be done in different ways. So this is also, for Einstein spaces, notice the following thing. For Einstein spaces, this is zero, the Cotton is zero, because the Schouten is proportional to the metric, so it's zero. And also, if you make the scouting proportional to the metric, you take traces of the vowel tensor, so it's zero, once again. So for any Einstein space, the Bach is zero. So it's a solution of conformal gravity. But there is another way of defining Einstein spaces, which is traceless Ricci tensor. And this, if you take it, you arrive at the same conclusion as Maldacena. You say the traceless Ricci tensor equal to zero is the same as the condition that he was taking, Neumann boundary condition for the metric. And so at the end of the day, if you evaluate the conformal gravity action in Einstein spaces, it's the McDowell-Mansouri action. So it's the renormalized action for in the context of ABS-CFT. So now I could formulate holographic renormalization in this way. If you want to renormalize an action, embed it in a conformal gravity and take the Einstein sector of the theory. Actually, we just did it in six dimensions, and it's far less trivial than this case, but I'm not going to talk about it today.
So Rodrigo, sorry, when you say conformal gravity action for Einstein spaces, you mean with therefore the Neumann boundary condition?
Yes. Yes. And this is McDowell-Mansouri.
Okay.
And that means Einstein-Hilbert with a topological term with a fixed coupling. So, okay, now that we know that we can embed Einstein gravity in conformal gravity, I will do it 5 minutes. So let's take conformal gravity written like quadratic terms in the curvature, and let's apply this prescription of Fursayev, Patrushev, and Solodukhin of conical defects. And what you produce in codimension 2 is a conformal invariant in codimension 2. You produce, it's difficult to classify conformal invariants in codimension 2 because it depends on both intrinsic and extrinsic geometry. Essentially, there are two. There are the traceless extrinsic curvature square. These two are separately conformal invariant. If you do it for vowel square in the bulk, it comes with a precise combination between these two. And it's interesting because conformal invariant is somehow inherited from the bulk. You do it, you promote it, you promote Einstein-Hilbert to conformal gravity, and you produce a conformal invariant in the codimension 2.
Can I ask you, how does this relate to the ambient space construction?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the ambient space construction is you start from the boundary of your ADS space, and you, instead of putting it into ADS, you put it into a plus 2-dimensional manifold, that is the ambient space. And there you solve the exact Einstein equation, and that gives you a dimension 1.
All right, but...
That's, you know, the Pfeffmann-Graham original construction.
And yeah.
And you have conformal symmetry acting on the...
Yeah, I think this is useful to prove that actually these functionals are renormalized, because you still have to prove.
Okay.
But this is something that we are dealing with at the moment.
I see.
So, okay. And you use plenty of this Gauss-Kodazzi decomposition in codimension 2. And if you take the, you can write it down in many different ways. And in particular, if you take the condition of minimality, you reproduce this Alexakis-Maseo formula of a standard renormalized action. But I'm interested to go beyond, for instance, to make contact with the notion of Willmore energy. The notion of Willmore energy is originally three-dimensional, but you can embed in four dimensions in a trivial way, because you can consider a product space. The ambient space is global ABS, so the vowel tensor is equal to zero. You can consider a time constant time slice. That means the extrinsic curvature along the time is zero. Also this condition. And then you produce certain formula that you can use extensively the Gauss-Golazzi decomposition in codimension 2. And after rinsing this thing and related, for instance, in a compact surface with the Euler, you can do it for a non-compact surface, or you can do it for a compact surface, like doubling the surface at the conformal boundary. And at the end of the day, you manage to reproduce. I mean, this is the original result, but there is also a paper by us in 2020 that we managed to reproduce using a different technique, the same result. Essentially, holographic entanglement entropy is also related to the notion of Willmore energy for two-dimensional surfaces. And maybe the most interesting result is the connection with non-minimal surfaces, that they had to include sort of constructively, and we managed to reproduce it from conformal gravity. This generalization of the notion of renormalized area that includes additional terms that depends on the extrinsic curvature, because it's not non-minimal. And this is essentially is a renormalized area plus K-squared contributions. This is a result by Fischetti and Weismann. And what is known, they were calling this expression that is called reduced Hawking mass as well. It's an energy functional that appears naturally in codimension 2. Just to summarize, so a single functional, this L sigma, which is conformal invariant, is useful to reproduce different cases, for instance, minimal, and the ambient space is Einstein, is renormalized area. For pure ideas or global ideas, and minimal surfaces is Willmore energy. And for non-minimal surfaces and Einstein is reduced Hawking mass. I don't know what is the other. I have not found it in the literature. So to conclude, I would like to emphasize the fact that, in a way, the fact that we restore Weyl invariance in the bulk, sort of embed Einstein gravity in conformal gravity, we manage to induce conformal invariance in codimension 2. So the renormalization in the bulk is somehow inherited. It should be inherited in codimension 2 as well. So what we are noticing is something intriguing, rather intriguing, connection between conformal invariance and renormalization, because we also work in a similar fashion in the six-dimensional case. This is highly non-trivial because conformal gravity in six dimensions is six derivative terms. There is obstruction tensors in this case. We managed to prove that for a generic Einstein space is a solution of this particular conformal gravity. And what we are interested in is to produce the generalization of this notion of Willmore energy. There is some literature about it in four dimensions as coming from six dimensions, from this particular conformal gravity theory that we didn't discover, but it was in the literature, is related to Lu and Pope previous work. Thank you very much.
Where did the picture of Willmore energy you take? Where did you take the picture? But
it's a funny story. I mean, I had never been to Durham, but they told me that it's in Durham, in front of a building that used to be occupied by mathematicians. Now they move, and now this journalist in front. So I wonder if the journalist comes out and see the sculptor, what they think of.
About more energy, like more physical. Can you remind me what physically they measure this energy? What is it?
It's like tension of membranes.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's a deviation respect to typically constant curvature, these sort of things.
Uh,
What would be the holographic understanding of Wilmot energy in the field theory?
Cassini and Lasso Andino with Moreno, they put some bounds, holographic bounds, based on Wilmot energy. I would say partly based on our results as well.
But I mean, say I take a 4D bulk gravity and I compute the boundary 3D CFT, what's kind of operator in the boundary? Is the Wilmot energy associated to?
No, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I know that these bounds are, they were able, I mean, it was known in mathematical literature that it holds some bounds. And they are useful in the holographic context.
I also had a question about boundary interpretation, because you mentioned that the area of like your codimension to like RT surfaces are conformally invariant. So does that mean like in the boundary theory you would have a conformally invariant regularization? And I don't know, maybe you can expand more intelligently than that.
No, I didn't get it. The idea.
Like, if you have, you've computed areas that correspond to entropies in the boundary, and these areas are finite, but we think that the entropy in it, the CFT, should be divergent because it's a CFT.
But in this case, it's fine.
In this case, it's finite.
Yes.
So then my question is, what?
So it had to be a number. It's not like logarithmic, like in the other case. In the other dimensions, it's logarithmic. In this case, it's finite. The universal part.
It's in even bulk.
It's even bulk dimensions.
It's the free energy. It's the coefficient of the. There's no logarithmic divergence in the entanglement entropy of the CFT.
Right.
In odd CFTs. So it's just computed the F function. It's the F function.
Yeah, it's the F function.
Questions? All right. Let's thank Rodrigo again.
Thank you very much.